There's like so much personal growth there. I mean, I had a therapist and I had a personal trainer and I had a speech coach for public speaking and like all of these, a small team of people trying to make me the best CEO in the world.
Welcome to a new episode of Venture Euro with me, Colleen Fabry. Our guest today is Alex Macau, the founder and CEO of Reflect App, the note-taking tool that allows you to take notes the same way you think by associating notes through backlinks. Reflect builds you a second brain that you can reference anytime. Prior to Reflect, he built and ran Clearbit, a venture-backed 50 million euro annual recurring revenue B2B SaaS company. During this episode, we discuss about his journey with Clearbit from hacking the first sales to using the SaaS sales playbook, the differences between building a B2B and a B2C company, and the power of a committed community. He's currently sailing around the world, and this interview was made while he was docking in Grenada. What a life. I made the mistake of thinking that maybe he was tipsy during the interview, a projection of mine, thinking that maybe that's what I would be doing, only to embarrass myself and find out that he doesn't drink at all. Oops. Please enjoy this excellent conversation with Alex Macau, founder and CEO of Reflect App. But before we get started, let's hear from our sponsors, which make this show possible. This episode is brought to you by Rose, the spreadsheet where data comes to life. Connected with your business data and delightful to share, Rose is how teams work with numbers and share their results. Head to rose.com/ventureeurope and find out how you can easily manage your cap table, plan your next fundraising round, or import data from your favorite tools. I already moved my spreadsheet to Rose and you can too. See for yourself how you can make your data come to life for free and visit rose.com/ventureeurope, that is ROWS.com/ventureeurope. I have already prepared some templates like cohort analysis, fundraising tracker, and cap table management, which I'm sure you'll find useful. This episode is also brought to you by Athletic Greens. If you're like me and travel a lot and sometimes have hectic days, AG1 will become your most reliable friend. AG1 further covers my bases with vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced micronutrients that support gut health and the immune system. I'm a sucker for morning routines and I started using AG1 3 months ago. One scoop, 250 milliliters of water, 75 high quality ingredients perfectly crafted to be well absorbed by the body, for a strong start of the day every day. With a 90-day money-back guarantee, you can test AG1 completely risk-free for 3 months. If you find that it doesn't meet your needs, you can get your money back, no questions asked. Right now, Athletic Greens is offering you, dear listeners of the Venture Europe podcast, a free year's supply of vitamin D3 and K2, which contributes to the maintenance of bones, teeth, muscle, and immune system, plus 5 AG1 travel packs when signing for a monthly membership. Visit athleticgreens.com/ventureeurope, try it risk-free for 90 days, support your nutrient supply, and start a new healthy routine. Top health experts and performers like Tim Ferriss, Andrew Huberman, and Lewis Hamilton recommend Athletic Greens. It also tastes great. Visit athleticgreens.com/ventureeurope to taste for yourself. Hey, Alex, how are you doing? I've heard that you're currently sailing around the world.
Yes. In January of last year, I just sailed from Cape Town to Grenada, so across the Atlantic.
And where are you at the moment?
So right now I am in Grenada and I am currently waiting for some friends to join me before we set out across the Grenadines.
Amazing. How big is the crew?
Well, it's 3 people joining, so we'll be 4 in total. I need at least one other person on board to run this boat. It's just a little difficult to do docking and that kind of thing. Across the Atlantic, there were 5 of us. And that was great because with 5 people, you have 2-hour shifts. It makes it quite easy to sail across the Atlantic because 2-hour shift is over before you know it. And so we did a month at sea and, you know, 2 hours on, 10 hours off, cooking and eating and sleeping and everything. It's in the Atlantic Sea in the middle of nowhere. That was quite the experience, I can tell you.
What was the motivation to do this trip?
I've always been a kind of YOLO kind of person, carpe diem and all that. I've always felt like you've got one life, you got to send it. So I was like, how can I, you know, make the most of it? And I was like, well, if I build a boat in South Africa and then sell that around the world, that seems like a great way of experiencing life and also becoming a lot more practical. You know, I was in San Francisco for a decade and I was quite helpless. You know, I think if like the Uber Eats delivery was late, I would probably starve. And I wanted to become a bit more practical in the world of atoms. So I work in the world of bits and bytes in software, but I wanted to actually become practical and understand how machines work and engines work and how the water maker works and how to fix it. And like, you are utterly on your own in the middle of the Atlantic. You know, we had an issue with our water maker which we used to basically convert seawater, which you can't drink, into fresh water. And we had an issue with it and we had to jerry-rig the parts and fix the issue ourselves because there's no one out there to help you. You are days away from the nearest human. You got to figure it out. There's no other choice. And there's something nice about that. You know, there's a sense of responsibility that your life is in your hands and you've got to figure it out. And I feel like we've kind of lost this a little bit in the modern age. That was some of the reasons that I wanted to do that.
If you think of Napoleon and Alexander the Great and other great men, like the dangers that they went through, and we are like, oh, my phone is out of battery.
I saw an amazing tweet the other day, too late to explore the world, too early to explore space, but just in time to build a B2B SaaS company.
On the world of Bits that you just mentioned. Actually, first time that I came across Clearbit, the company that you founded and you ran for about 6 years, was in 2017. I was actually implementing at a startup that I was working at to enrich the CRM with ideal customer profiles and then prioritize the leads. And it was just mind-blowing. I don't think it was another tool in the market that would do that. So both me that I was working as an expansion manager and my colleague that was a growth hacker, we just loved the product. So maybe you can tell us what was the vision when you started Clearbit and how did the journey play it out versus expectations?
Well, I started Clearbit in my mid-20s, having never run a large business before. And so I had no idea what I was doing at all. It was a complete naivety. And I actually think that can be a skill at some degree, because I think if you actually knew how difficult it was, you would never start. But the original business was actually called API Hub, which is quite a mouthful. And the idea was to essentially put an API in front of a lot of different data sources. And we did that initially. We had a lot of different sources other than the ones you mentioned around enrichment, but we quickly realized that the people who were really interested in buying from us are people who wanted the person and company enrichment. So essentially learning more about people and companies based on IP addresses and domain names and emails, because they wanted to sell to them better. You know, they wanted to know who was visiting their website and which of them were qualified. And basically, the more information you have during the sales funnel, the higher the likelihood that you are to convert people. So we started out with the APIs, and then we realized that our customers really didn't want API keys up front. They just wanted solutions. So then we built out the Salesforce integration, and that was when the business really took off. These days, it's like a 50 million revenue company and a few hundred people. We went from 0 to 1 in the first year, and it's 1 million ARR, and then 1 to 3, and then 3 to 7, I think. You know, the business has done really well, and it's been very capital efficient. We've hardly raised any money. We're cash flow positive. We've kept it quite efficient.
Yeah, so I was actually wondering, like, what is the difference when in the go-to-market strategy and in sales? I would assume that probably you had a more product-led growth sales. But what's the difference, like, in the journey on getting, let's say, the first 10, 50 customers? And then how is that different when you try to get to 1,000 customers?
It's very different. I'm not sure even Clearbit has 1,000 customers. You know, in B2B, SaaS, you don't need many customers to make lots of money. But, you know, to get the first 100 customers, we basically just hacked it. Like, this is what you have to do at the start. You have to do unsustainable things. Like, for example, I DM'd a lot of people on Twitter. Any, you know, any founder who was following me, I sent them a Twitter DM, you know. We did product hunt launches, you know. We were just quite loud. We made free tools. I had what's called the logo API that would turn a domain name into a logo, a company logo. And we released that for free. And that took off, you know. That was like the top of Hacking News for the day. People loved it. And we had one condition of using it that you had to link back to us. So then our SEO was incredible. We could rank for any keyword we wanted. We released more free tools, a Chrome extension called Clipboard Connect that 100,000 people ended up installing, or I think even more these days. And that got our name around as well. So, you know, it was a combination of these free tools and then just literally just trying to do unsustainable sales, like an outbound sales. And then the word got around, you know, you start this word of mouth growth engine that you can't really control. And then obviously the product's quality really matters. And for us, the product was the data. So we had to make sure the data was top notch to be able to be interested and continue buying from us. That was the early days. And then as we approached, you know, hundreds of customers, the playbook changes, you know. When the company is, you know, 60 people, you're a few years in, it's a bit more mature, and maybe you raised another venture round. At that point, you crack open the SaaS playbook, if you're in B2B at least. And that playbook works really well, honestly. You have dedicated sales teams to inbound. You try and make some kind of freemium so that you can easily attract people to the top of the funnel. And then you got your sales team that closes that. You got your SDRs. You've got the whole system that you see in all these B2B companies. Internally, they all look the same. And you can innovate it on bits and pieces, but often you'll find that you'll just kind of revert back to the mean because there was a good reason that people were doing the things that they were doing in most B2B SaaS companies. And so that's the nice thing about B2B SaaS. Consumer, on the other hand, is a different kettle of fish, and there's less tried and tested playbooks, in my opinion, for consumer. But for SaaS, at least you can use those playbooks.
And in 2020, you decided to step down as the CEO of Clearbit. What was the reasoning for that?
There's this really good framework I like called the Zone of Genius that a guy called Gay Hendricks came up with. Generally, people know what they're good at. So the mistake that people make is that they do what they're good at, not necessarily what gives them energy. Then they get burnt out. And they didn't think hard enough about how do I work on something that actually gives me energy? So to get to your question, what I realized was that it wasn't really giving me energy. And I also realized I wasn't very good at it. So it was a combination of those things. And a lot of founders, they have big egos, me included, of course. And so it's very difficult to get to that point where you're like, oh, actually, I'm not the right person for this job. And someone else could be. I could hire someone who's better than me to do this. And so it took many years kind of therapy and thinking to get to that point. But eventually I decided, you know, Alex, your skill set is in the early stage, the 0 to 1, you know, starting stuff, building stuff, programming. And then you should really get some help for the later stage because someone else can do it much better than you. So we did a CEO search. We found an amazing CEO to run the company. I stepped back. I'm still on the board. But it worked out really well. You know, we all basically just did what we're really good at. And we took our ego out of the equation. And everyone is happier for it. You know, the company is better managed. The employees are happier. The company's more successful. And I'm happier as well, building lifestyle businesses and going from 0 to 1, which is my core skill.
You also mentioned that usually in consumer products, you don't really have a playbook. I know that you recently founded Reflect app. At some point, I just saw it all over Twitter, this new super cool note-taking app that connects your thoughts much more like how your brain works. So the interconnectivity between different nodes. So that was pretty cool. What is the founding story? And what was the motivation to start a new company?
Well, I'm always going to be building companies in my life until the day I die. For the actual motivation for this company, it's very personal, which was I just wanted a tool for myself, a note-taking tool for myself that worked exactly how I wanted it to work. And I love programming. And so I was like, you know what? This is going to be a ton of fun to build. You know, after running a B2B company where you have to have a large team. And one of the big differences between B2B and B2C is if you want to do any kind of enterprise or mid-market sales, you need a large sales team, and then you need the supporting team for all of that, and you need a large marketing team, and it just balloons. I wanted a really small team, so that was one of the reasons I went with B2C. And then I wanted a product that I use myself every day, and again, another benefit of B2C. But I would say there are some major caveats and drawbacks to B2C. It's much harder to make money, you know, and B2B, making $1 million is not that difficult. B2C, it's very difficult. You know, Reflect just got to $21,000 monthly recurring revenue. Very humble beginnings, you know, and we're maybe almost 2 years in. It's definitely harder to make a sustainable business in B2C because of churn. You don't have net negative churn. You have like 3-5% monthly churn, and there's no expansion and so on. So it's very different. And there's pros and cons. And by the real reason that I decided to make Reflect was because I wanted to see it exist in the world. And I hoped that there would be other people like me out there who would enjoy it. And it turns out, I think there are. We have thousands of customers now.
I guess like when you look at consumers, they're very moody, but also very pretentious. And they like to get amazing things for free. So that's just a very, very difficult... Yeah. Market. I find that some businesses, also like in B2C, they have a great strategy to create enthusiasm in the market. And I guess you guys had a pretty good strategy in doing that. I was wondering, like, what was the secret of building demand before launching?
I have a little bit of a following on Twitter. So that has always helped. You know, whenever I've launched new products, having that following there has really helped because I just broadcast it to those people who know my work, and they think they trust that the quality products. So that helped. We did the classic launch on Product Hunt, of course. We stuck the email input up and started collecting email addresses. But really, the special things we did for the community came later on. We set up a Discord channel. We picked like the best people in our community in terms of like who contributed the most, and elevated them to another special channel. Make them feel even more special and listened to. We raised $1 million from our customers. I think really shows how committed they are to the products and how excited they are about the product. And then the other thing is like this product, so the people that use Reflect is probably the most important tool they have. Like they are in it every day, every hour of the day. It is an aid to their brain. It's a companion to their mind. And so they get pretty obsessive about it, you know? They, like, it's not just Reflect, any note-taking app. It's like, the bar is super high because people are in so much time in it. If you're spending a lot of time in a product, the bar is unbelievably high. Like, we have to be world-class at doing things like data syncing. And offline, and you know, we have end-to-end encryption, and we can't lose any data. My God, like if you lose someone's notes, that's the worst, right? So we have to be amazing at all these things. It is definitely more difficult than B2B for sure, but it's so much fun because I get to use the product every day, and I love my customers, and I get to I judge to the people that I'm helping and see their enthusiasm, and so. Would I may do another B2B company one day? Maybe, but for now, this is so much fun.
Hey guys, I just want to take a second to tell you about a private membership network we're launching in June. It is for founders and tech CEOs that raise the minimum 3 million euros or they are at 1 million euro annual recurring revenue. We'll have a monthly meetup facilitated by an executive coach and a yearly gathering in a fancy location. We already have some well-known names from the tech ecosystem signed up, from seed stage to unicorns to bootstrap bootstrap founders. If you're interested to join, head up to ventureeurope.eu and sign up. You'll see a link under resources. I also saw that you wrote your book in Notion. So I guess you knew that you're going to compete somewhat with Notion.
Oh, we don't compete with Notion. Notion is a wiki. The thing with these note-taking tools is it is impossible to IPO a note-taking company. It's just not a big enough market. There's like not enough virality, whatever it is. Like the biggest success story in note-taking is Evernote, and it's not much of a success story. So if it's something that's impossible to IPO and you raise money for it, like venture money for it, and then you're stuck in a conundrum. I mean, this happens to a lot of note-taking companies is the founders maybe get allured by VC investment and they take it. And then now what do they have to do? They have to grow really, really quickly and they have to exit. They have to sell the company or they have to IPO the company. IPO is impossible. Selling the company is definitely not impossible. That's usually what happens. And then Dropbox, who they sell it to, shuts it down, right? That is the life cycle of the note-taking company. And in terms of, and when it comes to Notion, they've raised the money. They have the $1 billion valuation. Okay, so how do you get enough users to justify that, right? The answer is adding viral features. So things like collaboration and team features and inviting people to the product. What that does is over time, it turns your products from and maybe a note-taking tool, which has started out as into a wiki. So where the primary customer is companies and it is for intercompany collaboration. It's not for notes. And it's just like an incredibly heavy tool to use for note-taking. It's like, it's slow. Because the thing about these tools is it is impossible to write a feature that is faster than one that doesn't exist. Does that make sense? You know, the more features you add to the product, the slower the product gets. So it's literally impossible for them to build a note-taking tool and also build in all the features for their companies, their main customers. Plus, they're making all the money from the company. So they have really no incentive to be a note-taking tool. So that is a very long answer to your question. And it's really interesting to see how incentives change things. You know, we're all driven by incentives, whether we like it or not. And so it's just much better to understand these incentives, you know? And so when it comes to raising money, man, that changes incentives all around. So you just have to go in it with your eyes wide open.
So I just discussed with David Heinemeier Hansen, which is the creator of Ruby on Rails. And he's like very much anti-venture capital. He's like, why would you raise venture capital? Why would you have someone else as a boss? And also now you touched a little bit on the incentives and previously you've raised some venture capital. Now it kind of seems that you're backed by the community and also you have crowdfunding. What is your view on those three choices?
Oh, wow. So first of all, DHH is wrong. There is nothing moralistic involved in raising capital. It is not morally good or morally bad. It is just a tool. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to pick the right tool for you and what you're trying to do. Like I said before, make sure if you're going to raise venture capital that your company can IPO. If it can't, you're really screwing your company and you're going to make a lot less money than if you just ran a lifestyle business and paid yourself a dividend. So that's like the main thing to bear in mind. Obviously, there's some businesses you can't do without raising a lot of money. Like if you're doing some kind of biotech or some kind of hardware company, there's a lot of upfront costs involved. So you got to take that into account. You got to take into account team size. You got to take into account if there's any like natural inbounds to your idea that will reduce marketing costs. There's all sorts of things. And then you have to take into account what you personally want out of life. And I have no regrets raising money for Clearbit. It was absolutely the right thing to do for that business. Like for a large B2B SaaS company with a lot of headcount, you need that capital to grow. And of course, it is possible, you know, there's companies like MailChimp that have managed to get around that. But you know why? It's because they send a MailChimp link in their emails. They're like for free acquisition. You know, if you can do that, great. If you can't, just raise venture. And what's great about venture, is it forces you personally to grow. You have to be on peak performance. You are growing the company really quickly. You are hiring and firing executives with way more experience than you. And you somehow have to figure out which ones to hire and which ones to fire. And you are dealing with the mental stress, you know, and like there's this like so much personal growth there. I mean, I had a therapist and I had a personal trainer and I had a speech coach for public speaking and like all of these, a small team of people trying to make me the best CEO in the world. And like that's amazing for me selfishly, because I get to grow and become a better human, or at least it helps in that respect. That's the pro to venture, you know. Obviously, there are a lot of pros to bootstrapping or crowdfunding. I will put those kind of under the same bucket. I think the nice thing about crowdfunding is it reduces the amount of early pain. I would say bootstrapping, there's a huge amount of pain initially, just because you have no money. You have to do everything yourself, and it just takes a long time. But then venture, you know, you get that money up front, and that's nice, but you get the pain later when you're running like 200 person company. So it's kind of like pick your pain, right? The nice thing about crowdfunding is it's a kind of a cheat code where you can have all the benefits of bootstrapping, but have a bit of money early on. So we raised $1 million from our customer base. At that point, we already had a product out there that people liked and used, and you absolutely need to get to that point. Like, if you're not technical, you can't program, you can't get a product out there, maybe you don't have good enough taste to build something, you're not going to succeed anyway. You won't be able to crowdfund because people are not going to believe in your idea if you can't build it these days. You know, there's so many easy ways of building businesses. So, you know, you have to build the product, but then you can raise $1 million from your customers. And now your customers are really invested in the company. They not only do they use the products every day, but they're financially motivated too. For them, like a lot of the time it's their first investment ever. So I have a lot of fun writing these company updates to our investors. We have hundreds and hundreds of investors. And I basically have turned our updates into like a startup school, you know, where we basically get really vulnerable and we talk about all the great and the worst things about running businesses, because a lot of people who invest in Reflect are very curious about starting their own business. For them, it's like an expensive Kickstarter that, you know, might have a return or not, right? So I've really enjoyed like kind of building this community and taking people along the journey with me and being vulnerable with them and showing them how the sausage is made.
That's amazing. And also, I would assume that they have all the incentives for the business to go well and for the product to be the best that it can be.
Yeah, they do. And they also have an incentive to spread the word as well, which is good for us. You know, now we have hundreds of people who are spreading the word of Reflect. I would say when it comes to feedback, one of the best things about being in the note-taking business is, boy, do you get feedback. Because your customers like to write. Like, you get like pages and pages of feedback. That's also one of the hardest parts of building a note-taking company, is there's no real right answer. And if you try and build everyone's definition of a right answer, I guess that is that's the wrong answer. You please no one. So I have to be treading this line of being really curious and listening to feedback, but also being really stubborn and just building exactly what I want.
How big do you think this can get?
Reflect can get probably to 5 to 10 million ARR, run it with a 10-person team. And I think that will probably be enough, honestly. You know, not everyone will want a note-taking tool or be interested in this kind of thing. Not everyone wants to pay $120 a year for a note-taking tool when they got Apple Notes for free, you know? So I know that maybe the market is a little niche. And also, I just don't want to grow massively. I don't want to have a big team. I want a boutique tech company. You know, why don't we build more of those? Tech companies are so cheap to run, you know, the margins are great. Like, why don't we have like all these mom and pop tech companies? It's a shame, because what I love about small companies, or at least like being a customer of a small company, is that the founder does support. It's kind of ironic that in like a venture-backed company, the best support you'll ever get is in the first year when the founder is doing it. And then after that, it just degrades. But with these boutique lifestyle businesses, the founder and the early team are doing the support forever. And so, you know, if you chat to someone, you're going to get the perfect answer. Someone who has total context and knows everything about the product. So, you know, it's just nicer to work with these companies. You just got to make sure that they're not going to go anywhere. You know, they're not going to go out of business. So that's why we're racing towards profitability. We want to announce to everyone we're profitable. We're around forever. You know, you can trust us. You know, we're not going to try and get acquired. We're not going to try and IPO. We're just a notes app. That's all we do.
Love that. Let's change gears a little bit and let's get personal. I really like that you've been through the stages in your career and in your life that right now you can be intellectually honest with yourself, but also with others. So you're not maybe like the entrepreneur in the first 2 years. I want to make something big. I want to create a 1 billion euro company, but you know exactly what you want and you know why you want it. And I was wondering, is that a function of you becoming rich after Clearbit? Were you always the same? And how did your view on life change once you became a millionaire?
No, I was definitely more money motivated when I was younger. That's for sure. Now I think I have a much better perspective about the universe and how small we are. And, you know, there's 100 trillion suns. it's insane. And so I think I have a really good perspective on life, or at least certainly a better one than 20-year-old Alex had. So I definitely want to try and experience and make the most of my one life. You know, does money help with that? Sure. I would say money helps to a certain extent. For me, especially not having to work for anyone else, like knowing that I never had to work for anyone else again, that was a huge relief. Like, some people don't care about working for other people. For me, that's like my worst nightmare. So that was the biggest relief. Other than that, you know, you just got to be careful with money. I had a really good analogy of money being like gas in a car. You know, you need gas to go places, but the point of life is not to go on a tour around gas stations, right? I have definitely some friends who are very lost in terms of money and the meaning of money and just trying to have as much as possible. So I try and ride that balance, you know? It's nice to have a bit of money, but you don't want it to become like addicting and the sole focus of your life.
I agree. I mean, you should definitely use money to enrich your life and not let, you know, in yourself, you be the one addicted to money. I mean, I also resonate quite a bit on not liking to have a boss and just working on something that you love. And also on the fact that you are dead billions and billions and billions of years, and now you're alive, and then you're going to be dead billions and billions and billions of years. So you just have like this one window where the universe can observe itself back and wonder of all this beautiful creation. So then just make sure that you balance that with your curiosity and exploring and learning and meeting new wonderful people. So I definitely resonate with that. And looking back, what was the most challenging period in your career and how did you overcome it?
Oh, wow. That was a lot of challenging periods. At one point, my green card got denied and I got chucked out of the United States. You know, or like even earlier on when I dropped out of high school when I was 17 and moved to London, I was incredibly lonely and I just didn't know anyone my own age and in the workforce. And it was really, that was very difficult. You know, and then there were definitely difficult parts scaling Clearbit. Every company is a shit show internally. People sue you every now and again. There's HR issues, this and that. I would say overall, I'm going to cheat with your question and just say I've been very fortunate and my problems haven't been real problems. It's been a lot of fun, honestly, in general. If you average it out, it's been a lot of fun. And the problems that I've had generally are not problems a year from now. That's usually how I evaluate, should I be super worried about something. It's like, will this be a problem a year from now? If not, it'll figure it out.
The last question, if Alex from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell him?
Yeah, sometimes I think about this. I actually wrote a blog post exactly about this because I was going to go and do a talk to a bunch of Berkeley kids. And I was like, you know, what would I tell myself if I was, you know, went back in time for 10 years, which is kind of what I was doing with these students. And so I've got a long blog post and a lot of it is like, you are the average of your friends. Like, you, location is really important. And move to San Francisco at the time, at least. But if I had to just say one thing to myself, I would probably just give myself a hug and be like, it's going to be all right. Aww. You know, don't worry too much. It's all good.
Don't worry too much. It's all good. Thanks so much, Alex. And where are you headed next? So you're in Granada right now?
Up to St. Vincent and the Grenadines next. So we're just figuring out the Chinese visa, but as soon as that's figured out, then we're going to do a company offsite. We're going to sail around and hack from the boat near Starling. So I don't know if anyone, company's ever done that before, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Sounds the best trip for the company. Alex, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thanks so much. Cheers.